He's so funny.
Sorry, I wish I had more useful information. I don't. I'm just joshing.
It gets so hot in here, though, before the show. I always feel like I should have a little bit of a sleepy sleep.
We're going to get you some coffee.
You got this thing going, or are you just like fucking around like some sort of fuck?
It's going and it looks good.
In fact, it's even working a straight line in between the when we're talking. It's just a...
Oh, it has to be a straight line, not a gay line.
No.
You racist and homophobic son of a bitch.
Racist.
Think about it. Hello and welcome to another episode of Sounds from the 70s with Gary and Rob, sometimes known as the man with the golden gun.
I'm not repeating that one.
I got him on that one, boys and girls.
I couldn't find a voice for it.
My man, I couldn't do it.
You got me.
Coming to you from a place where no civilized man would go and no wild animal would go unmolested. Today, Rob.
Well,
is very much the well is completely dry today. Or, in other words, the pen has run out of ink.
I think we've discussed
that. Or, in other words, I ain't got nothing. A little bit of writer's block, I think, after 167 scripts compared to Rob's none.
Well, I wrote a quarter of a script once, but it was rejected.
Oh, and for good reason. Since it was not usable in any way, shape, or form in any type of podcast, even the gardening one.
It wasn't even vulgar or tasteless.
It was nothing.
It was nothing.
It's like, Yes. Why? What are you writing? This sentence doesn't lead to that sentence. None of these sentences are related. Well, what are you doing?
I'd rather have had a script where a man was telling about the things that he was doing while he was pooping. That would be much more interesting than the script I read from you.
I could write another one.
Just like but you pooping? Yes, that would be hilarious. So what we are going to do to start the show today, and this is a bad idea right from the start.
Oh, boy.
Is we're going to have a bull session to see if we can come up with ideas for future shows. Since I have to come up with every fucking idea on this show. Ooh. Sorry for the language, but I do. Ooh. So, before we start, I'm going to tell you it's not a good idea. But I got nothing. I got absolutely nothing. So this is not a good idea, this bull session. I'm going to tell you right now. Get the kids out of the room, because this is going to be ugly. And I promise you, we will not turn up anything useful.
No.
This is what you call a time waster. Can you do the time waster thing, Rob?
Time waster.
Wah, 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 wah.
That's our time waster theme.
But first,
that was one of our segments that never really got off the ground.
No, because time waster kind of sounds like we didn't give a shit. This is the last of our tribute episodes, and today we are paying tribute to the recently departed David Crosby, affectionately known by myself and his friends as the Cross, who left us at the age of 81, about 50 years later than we thought he would.
Yeah.
And even the Cross would say the same thing. We will be reviewing the 1975 album by David Crosby and Graham Nash called Wind on the Water. And no, not that type of wind that Uptown Mike used to make every week when he was working on the show.
His wind was broken.
It was a broken wind.
It was a broken wind.
This is actual wind from heaven. Isn't that nice? That's a good album title. That's an album title if I was making New Age music. It'd be called Gary is Making Wind from Heaven.
And if I had a mind as soft as mush, I'd buy it.
That's the kind of music I listen to all the time when I'm writing and stuff. It's the new age easy listening music because it doesn't tax my brain.
No, just think of a majestic wind.
Oh, Majestic Glitch. Majestic. That's a nice title, too. Makes me feel like calm and relaxed.
That's a win that doesn't mean any harm.
So now, unfortunately,
we have to do something.
It's time to find out what ideas we have for future shows. Now, Rob, what were you thinking of maybe, what type of segment would be good for the show?
Sounds from the 70s. We are concentrating mostly on music. Is that correct? If not exclusively?
Hey.
Mostly or exclusively? There are two different things.
Answer the question, sir.
Cannot be both. Cannot be one or the other.
I object. This is harassing the witness, Your Honor. No, well, this show started as encompassing all of the 70s with the main theme of the music of the 70s. But as we will find out a little bit later, just I was really bit. High. That was a good head. We will, we're going to bring back a popular segment today, which has nothing to do with music, but the 70s. So we may try and get back into the zeitgeist of the whole 70s as a decade that I kind of abandoned because we had a lot of music we got stuff.
Wrapped up in music.
Yeah, we got so wrapped up. We were like a burrito.
We were like an idiot with a roll of cellophane.
I don't understand it. Well, I understand it, but I don't want to. So anyways, after answering your question, what was your idea for future segments on the show?
Oh, well, I was going to recommend we can get outside of music, comedy albums were big in the 70s, which
we've had this, how big they are. I have had this eternal debate
of whether to do
for the I don't know how long we've been on, five years?
A bunch
years,
of years.
4 years. Plus about 2 years while I was planning it, whether we would have comedy albums. And I have gone back and forth on it. And it usually falls on the negative because comedy albums, first of all, even the great ones, only last for two or three listens at the most. And it moves on and... It's hard to describe a comedy album. Like it's.
I really like his jokes about this, but I didn't like his jokes about this.
Exactly.
That was easy.
That was the biggest problem, actually. That was the biggest problem. Is how do you describe a comedy bit? And I found that it was too unsatisfying to do as a review. Because you can't reveal the jokes in any real way. You can say that, George Carlin said a lot of jokes about smoking pot or something.
Topic which was very humorous at the time.
So I like the idea. I just don't think it's practical.
It's not practical, yeah.
Yeah.
How do you,
We might have a, you know what we might do?
Comedy and this is too subjective.
You know what? I would like you to shut the fuck up for a
you
second.
You know what? I'm not going to interrupt you again for the next 30 seconds.
That actually, bringing that up was a good idea. We should do a segment or two, and not a review, but a segment or two on comedy albums and just rate comedy albums that we like or comedy albums that we don't like. Now, we would have to do this incognito, so to speak, because we would have to listen to a whole bunch of comedy albums.
Yeah, I'd have to like think, how many comedy albums do I know?
Yeah, and then we'd have to find them on here and then listen to them. And you don't have to listen to every comedy album, but you know what I mean. You could have a whole bunch of comedy albums and stuff. And maybe in a year's time, we come back and say, or a couple of years, I like that idea, you know, to say this actor's funny. These Monty Python guys, you know, I don't know if you've heard of them, but I think they're a new sensation and, you know, they are fabulous. Something like that.
They're dated. They won't fly.
Something like that. Yeah. And you could say, well, I listen to that. And that's a good idea because you could say, you know, I listen to the Monty Python albums and they don't translate well on record like they do on the shows of the movie. Yeah. That's, you know, that's something we could do even for each individual act, is that we could, instead of doing a whole, just an album of somebody, let's do a catalog of Monty Python and take 6 months or a year and every 2 weeks, just listen to one and then listen to another one, blah, blah, until we're done. And then we'll come back and do a whole segment or maybe do a whole review of a catalog. of a Monty
the
Python
overall overview of the work there. That
and we don't have to do like everything. Like we could do George Carlin in the '70s, so that we would have to do his whole catalog.
Yeah, I wouldn't be doing the whole thing because
no,
a lot.
Right?
I listened to them all, but that's a lot.
Then we come, we do a George, our Richard Pryor in the '70s. We could do something like that, and then we could do about albums that you should stay away from because they're just not funny, and that will give reasons. I like the idea, Rob, because you have bantied this about as I have for the. For years, going back, going back 6 or 7 years,
how it fit in, but it's not practical with the regular album reviews. Yeah,
no, it's different than the musical album reviews. It's definitely different. But I see now how we can do it, and that is actually a good idea. And that breaks my promise of this being a worthless endeavor about this bull session. But that was actually a good idea.
Might be made to work.
But of course, it's not a next week type of thing. It's it's a extended period of time type of thing. But I think it's worth it because the one thing that was always made me want to do it is that we are excluding it. Then when we said we would never exclude anything that was kind of related to popular music,
it's pretty much most of what is going to be put on albums in the '70s.
Yeah, and by the way, to our younger listeners out there, comedy albums were huge back then. Mm-hmm. I got Up in Smoke album when I on my birthday
Up
in 1978.
Yeah, I got a couple Cheech and Chong. I was Steve Martin.
Steve Martin. I gave a friend I wanted to impress when I was 11 years old, and she liked Steve Martin, so I bought her a Steve Martin album for her birthday. And it was a good, like, record albums were of course very popular to buy, just like CDs are and stuff like that today.
Yeah, kind of had not too much else.
And there wasn't much else because you didn't reveal too much about it. You didn't want to give somebody like a heart or somebody and find out, as for you, that the guy didn't like it. Get it? The guy didn't. No, but... Sorry. But you know what I mean. You didn't want to get anything too personal because it's school, right? And sometimes you can pick names. I know we picked a lot of names.
Yeah.
And everybody would switch out.
Yeah, and you didn't know what it was. And you just kind of have to guess. And
Exactly. So a big thing that people talked about, I know... In the schoolyards, we talked a lot about Cheech and Chong because they were the really counterculture band at the time. And
yeah, they were the ones that the nicer parents didn't want you listening to.
They were the ones because George Carlin really hadn't gotten that counterculture big yet.
Yeah.
He was still kind of in the early and mid 70s, still kind of doing his I'm trying to be mainstream type of thing, and it really didn't hit until the mid 70s. And even then, it wasn't his albums. His albums, I amend that because the AM/FM and everything, they hit with the college crowds. They didn't hit with us young kids going into elementary school.
Cheech and Chong were the ones. Everyone heard of Class Clown. But
right. Those albums were popular, but they were popular for... He didn't break all ground until probably the late 70s or so. And then Richard Pryor also... Until he came out with his, he was known as a comedian, but he was known for his films until the late 70s when his brilliant stand-up movies came out, which I remember watching with my friends. We would rent it and we'd watch his stand-up, especially Richard Pryor in concert, his first one. And we would die laughing. We could watch it over and over again. It was just hilarious.
I'd heard of Richard Pryor as a kid, but I'd also heard his comedy was blue enough that...
It was blue.
Yeah, that it was not easy to find.
Don't you feel that going blue can be such a waste?
It can for Jackie Rogers.
Says Red Skeleton.
Because he does it wrong.
Red Skeleton, by the way, did not like blue humor. So just in case you want.
It's a waste.
That's a good idea, Rob. I like it.
I was wondering how to incorporate it because, I was thinking, we ought to cover it, but how?
You're right. No, you're right. And it just came to me. And I tried, it's funny how I tried for 7 years to figure out how to incorporate it. And just in that one suggestion, it came to me. I didn't put the timer on, so you're in charge of the time tonight.
We started at 8 minutes and we were at 19:15. Okay,
I don't trust you.
I look at my time, I subtract 8 minutes and it still won't matter because the show will be as long as it is.
No. Do I have any ideas? I have to come up with, so far, with 166 ideas for the show.
Musical ideas, what have we missed? There's a lot we haven't done yet, isn't there?
Oh, yeah. I have no problems with the album reviews. and stuff like that.
Okay.
What I have, I have enough themes for the next 10 years.
Segment
I
do. Ideas.
Yeah, but segment ideas and things like this at the beginning of the show or stuff. It's really hard to come up with something, and I'm not belly aching because it's a pleasure to do. It really is. But sometimes, and I knew it was going to come that I would hit a dry spell where nothing's kind of happening in music, so there's nothing to really talk
about.
That's
what I thought. It was a bit of a dead spot.
It was a bit of a dead spot. I just thought that we could come up with some ideas. I actually don't want to go back to the way it was, where we had kind of bits and stuff like that. I kind of like what we do. What we do on this show is we kind of had a monologue for 10 minutes, if anybody is wondering. If they've recently tuned in, we kind of have a monologue for 10 minutes. We have odds and ends, which is our kind of wrapping up of mistakes that we may have made in the past and little bits that aren't big enough for segments, but I want to put in.
Yeah, bits of musical news.
Yes, and then I like to flesh out the rest of the first half hour with a segment that I think is important about the 70s or music. And that's the part. The last half hour or more is with the album review. I have no problem with that. It's just finding those little tidbits. And I think it's just basically just a fallow period right now. I'm not really worried, but that's such a great idea by Rob. One of the people I didn't expect to have an idea. I thought he'd say something like, I don't know, watching birds. We can do that. Talk about the birds we watched today. I thought he'd say something stupid like that, but
how
it was very smart.
How about talk about cooking and recipes?
How about...
You got something?
I do. How about the same type of thing, but...
Different.
Not for rock soundtracks.
Oh.
But for film soundtracks in general. Because it's hard to review a film soundtrack. You know what I mean? Like actual orchestral music.
Yeah.
But it's also something I don't want to maybe dismiss and just have albums like Grease and stuff like that. God, Grease was that was a punishment beyond all repair. Not the first side. The first side was lovely and I loved it. It was the other three sides that made me think that there was no God.
Someone was punching me in my soul.
Why are you hitting my soul? And we have quite a few albums that we can do on the vocal rock pop side and stuff like that. But it'd be interesting, although I do find those albums quite boring. So that's another. And
there's music made not to entertain but to pacify.
Pacify your audience into sleeping. Kind of like New Age music.
Yeah.
Don't think. We're just going to leave that. We're not going to do that. What we're doing is a bull session. Is that we're just saying
an idea, but let's put it on the table, and then we'll just see if it works.
Let's see if it flies off the table and sticks to the window. And if it sticks to the window, then we got it.
Then we need a new window.
So we'll leave that. Hey, if you come up with one good idea, then you've had a good bull session. And we did. Or you did.
And we did.
Yeah, we did. Very good idea. But the thing I want to know right now, and this is important to me, because I need a drink of water, is, Rob, how was your work week? How's your work? How was your week? That was a little bit of a Freudian slip right there.
Indeed.
So how was your week? And please, I am actually very thirsty, be as detailed as possible.
Oh, okay. I might be getting close to being gainfully employed again soon. My old workplace has still not called me. I don't think they've got any contracts. So I've been looking for a job in a new place, and the new place looks good. And then I still can't get in touch with the people to get the job. But
you can't talk that fast. I have told you about this because it loses people's interest. You can't have a long sentence with no
breaks
in it. You can't say, oh, and I went to work, and then after that, I got a call from the doctor's office saying I had a clap. But I said, why can't I get the clap? I didn't sleep with anybody. Oh, yeah, there was that guy. You can't do that.
I used to talk like that all the time when I was a six-year-old.
you gotta go, you know what's funny, Gary? You know what's funny is that I couldn't find a work this week. See, you got to be like that. You got to be like a grizzled old man.
I have little memory of what happens during the week.
But that's not the point, Rob. I'm just telling you that if you would just put the pauses in, then it would actually be so much better. No matter what you said, if you would just pause up and say, "Well, I tell you, I went down to the department store," and you're probably wondering what department store I went to. I can't tell you that because it's X-rated. You see, the humor right there is hilarious because of the pauses.
That's getting into government broadcasting
territory. That's how you do it.
Put those pauses in, and then suddenly
you never listen, and anyways, odds and ends. Lost time is not found again.
As we've just proven.
Well, I told you before, I have nothing because I have a little bit of writer's block. So all of you who are expecting something to automatically just pop up for odds and ends, well, you were sadly mistaken. Because I told you I had nothing. So
I came in with nothing. That's odd. And now this segment is over. That's the end. Odds and ends.
This would actually be a good time if we did this sort of thing.
To
have a guest on here we could interview. Oh, and but we don't have one, and we never. I wish we had in the past, but we probably never will. We were talking about getting Eric Clapton's chauffeur's brother on here, but
the stories he could tell.
Oh, secondhand. My God. No, secondhand. The stories he could tell from his brother. Oh my God. Rob, this is an interesting question. If you could have any guest in the world, living or dead, on our show to interview, who would it be?
Wow. I'd have, I want to talk to someone or something. I never wanted to talk to anyone before. You know what? I got nothing. Living or dead, who would I talk to? My whole life is an attempt not to talk to people. Let me think.
Attila the Hun?
Not really, no. I did. Attila the Hun has fallen into disfavor with me.
Oh, Hitler would be funny, wouldn't it? If we had Hitler here, we'd go like, "What were you thinking, man?"
What was it, Putin? I'd kind of like to ask him the Ukraine situation. What, do you think you're going to hold it? I play Risk. Nobody holds the Ukraine. What are you doing?
You see, I'd rather talk to people
who are dead
because they can't do anything. Whereas a Putin could, like, "Oh, that's a nice question." You know, you're dead. You know?
Jimmy Hoffa, where are you now?
What have you been doing? I would choose, since you would choose nobody, kind of expected because you never give answers.
Why do I want to talk to anyone? Your question, the line of questioning is presumptuous.
I would choose Buddy Hackett. I would like to know what's in that genius mind of his. What makes him the comedy genius that is Buddy Hackett? That's what I want to know.
And is that your real name, Buddy Hackett? It seems to me that caring parents don't call their male children Buddy.
Yeah, that's a funny first name, isn't it?
That's a funny first name.
Yeah, there has to be a... Do you want me to look that up? I could look that up and see what his
first name is, Buddy.
I'm going to look it up. You think I'm not going to look it up? I'm going to find out before the end of the show. In fact, if I can get you to hold the mic, not actually hold the microphone, but hold the audience's attention for a minute, I can find out in a second. I would also like to say that I would settle. You can see how desperate we are today. We're trying to figure out people who are dead that we love to have on the show. But I would also settle for Monty Hall. Now,
Monty, yeah.
There must be a lot of juicy backstage stories from Let's Make a Deal.
He could tell, because that'd be a great show.
Those are stories that are dying to be told. They're like, "Oh, I was just walking down the hall, and all of a sudden, I got goosed. Who was it? Monty Hall goosed me in the ass." Like stories like that. Oh, that'd be so funny. And he said, "Hey, big boy, why don't you come into my dressing room after the show?"
If I find out Monty Hall was the victim in most of these encounters, I'll be shocked.
I could see him, though. I could see, like some big bear of a guy and say, "Oh, Monty."
I'm thinking those gorgeous women models. They couldn't get their hands off of him.
Poor guy. I'm going to look up this Buddy Hackett thing. Rob, you were inducted into the Army about 5 years ago. How did that work out?
didn't work out too good because they kept telling me to do things. I'm like, no, I don't want to do this. And they get mad. And
Leonard.
Leonard. Buddy's real name is Leonard.
Leonard Hacker. Hacker, not Hacker. Hacker. Leonard Hacker. So for all of you who were just dying for that news, you can now rest tonight.
Buddy was just a stage name.
See, you can see that. You can see, like Leonard or Lenny. That is, it does evolve into, hey, buddy. Like, I don't want to call you Lenny. That's a bullshit name. I can see somebody in his youth saying, you know what? Leonard, that's a bullshit name. I'm going to call you Buddy because you're my buddy and I like you and you're funny and you look funny.
You don't look like an egghead. You don't look like a Leonard.
Okay, where are we? Oh, yeah, we got... okay, so let's pretend... Let's pretend I have something for 70s memories on today's show. 70s memories.
Hey, how about all those disposable goods made of plastic?
Don't interrupt me doing the 70s theme memories song. Theme.
I forgot we had one. It's been a while since we've done 70 memories.
Oh, it's been about 3 years.
Yeah, I forgot about it.
Today we're going to talk about, since I had nothing I could find, we're going to talk about not actually some really bad shows in North America on TV in the 1970s. We're going to talk about one that I may have talked about this before on this show. I can't remember. There was a show on TV here in Canada, and trust me, I think the British had really great shows, actually.
We just got to see all the good ones. In the 70s.
And I think Europe had a lot of... Even the Soviet Union had some pretty good
I think we just got a filtered view of them.
I don't know. I remember George Harrison being on Dick Cavett. And Dick Cavett asked him, which you can either see on DVD or buy it on DVD. It was a fascinating interview, and I said one. And he asked him... what's the big difference, you know, when you come over here to America? And he said, oh, the television shows are so bad compared to Britain. and he says, and he had a very good point, which me and Rob have both said our piece about this, which makes no sense in a North American point of view. It really doesn't. And in Britain, it's so brilliant. And it's 2 points. It's one, that in North America, you show commercials in the middle of the shows, which is terrible. It's really stupid. And in Britain, they'll show however long the show is. It could be 26 minutes. It could be 24. It could be 28. It could be 32 sometimes.
In its entirety?
In its entirety. And then they will show the commercials at the end. All the commercials at the end of the show. You didn't know that?
I'm not able to even imagine that.
That's why you see all the Monty Python shows without commercials, and they were aired on PBS is because they had such a, it just ran like consecutively. To put commercials in it in the middle just didn't make sense because you didn't understand where you left off because it was a show that was meant to be watched.
Yeah,
and all their shows are like that. They might have the end of part one and then let you go for a break if it's a long movie or something, and then you'd go and take a break for 5 minutes while they aired the commercials and come back and show a movie for an hour and a half. What a great idea. Now the second idea, he said, because he couldn't understand it, George Harrison was really infuriated that Americans and Canadians had commercials in the middle of the shows, which I understand. Like, holy smokes. When you think about it, it's natural for us. But when you think about it compared to, like, just showing the show, it's ridiculous. Yeah. Stupid and ridiculous.
I can't think of a time when I ever watched just the show all the way through.
Yes. In fact, it's not like that now. Like, the networks still do that, the big networks. But now you go, like, to anywhere, to Netflix, where they all have their shows. And it's all streaming. And there's no commercials, of course. And that's the way Britain had it, like, 50, 60 years ago. And, of course, he had the thing, why I don't understand why you have to have 24 shows in a season, or 26 shows
in a season. Oh, yeah, because they turn out, like, one a week during the production time.
He says, you know, and he always mentioned Monty Python, because even then, when he was on there in 1971, and Monty Python was only, like, 2 years old or something like that, he said, we have a show out there, not Monty Python, and sometimes they'll air 7 shows if they feel that that's their season. Why can't you guys do that? And Dick Cavett said, he agreed. Dick Cavett was a very cultural person, and And he had actually seen Monty Python, one of the few people in North America that had. Other than Canada, we actually started watching Monty Python in 1970 because of our CBC, BBC connection.
Yeah, they bought shows from the BBC. Yeah.
America had very rarely seen any. In fact, I don't think they had seen any by 1971. But Dick Cavett had, and he said they were brilliant. And he said, you know, I can't believe that they only have 7 shows. What a great idea. And nobody, and it took cable TV all that time since George Harrison made that comment. It took about, I don't know, 20 years later for them to actually say, hey, 12 or 13 shows a season is enough. And, you know, not having commercials and stuff like that. And the quality of the shows, I don't know a lot about what the BBC
when
aired.
You're making them faster, the quality, you don't have as much time for detail. Mm-hmm.
That's why I think there was a lot of good, as George Harrison said, I can only take his word from it. So that's why there's so many good shows. He says in Britain, there's so many good shows. And trust me, I think the thing that suffered the most in the 70s, which we talked about, was the cultural clash, of course. So you had Barnaby Jones. I'm always picking on Barnaby Jones. Yeah. But kids do not want to watch a 75-year-old private detective solving crimes. They just don't. Even the people he hired to do all the legwork for him were middle-aged.
I can't think of too many people my age who were big Matlock fans at the time it was out.
Well, at least Matlock was later, right? That was, and it appealed to people. They had already had the separation of this is the older crowd now. But back then, there was the clash of, you know, the younger people have taken over the pop culture. They should be running the television stations. But the older people still were. They were putting on, you know, shows for older people and nothing for the younger people. Except for like Starsky and Hutch and stuff like that.
They had their formulas.
And they kept on thinking that, you know, this will work when it's like, you know that the big demographic is the young kids and you guys aren't going after them. Anyways, a lot of bad shows. They weren't very funny. They weren't cutting edge like in Britain with, you know, Fawlty Towers and Monty Python's Flying Circus. They just weren't. I could name in the whole of the 1970s, just off the top of my head, probably 4 shows that I really, like, I thought they were funny because I was a kid, but I want to watch them now, like Happy Days. It's a terrible show. It's not funny at all.
Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley.
It's had good entertainment. It's entertaining, yep. But it's not funny at all.
I remember I smoked a big reefer and I was watching The Facts of Life. Right in the middle of the show, I just sat up and thought, this is not very good.
It took you a reefer to understand that?
It took me a reefer, yeah. Wow. Most of the time I didn't pay that much attention. But
The shows that I can think of that were funny in the 70s in North America, and I'm not counting Saturday Night Live and SCTV because they were not aired in prime time and they weren't.
Okay, yeah.
They were not prime time shows. They were
specialty jobs.
They were specialty. They were special. Yeah. When you think of the prime time shows, I can think of like MASH. I can think of like Soap.
Bob Newhart.
Bob Newhart and Mary Tyler Moore. Yep. Hilarious. At times, All in the Family, although All in the Family got a little bit political, especially when I was a young kid.
When it got in the just later years.
In the
later
years.
Off really good.
Yes. So 5 shows, I can, just off the top of our heads, 5 shows. Those are brilliant shows, by the way.
They started to come in with some more good ones in the late 70s.
Yes, in the late 70s.
Barney Miller and Taxi.
Barney Miller again. WKRP. Again, I'm sorry, because those are 2 brilliant shows, and I left them out. I think if we tried, we could come up in the whole decade.
Ten shows.
That's not very good when you probably come up with a whole bunch of shows, new shows every year, and you can come up with 10 actually funny shows that you can laugh at now and laugh at then. And it was not a good time. There was a show, Rob, can I ask you what time we're at? Because I may not get into this if it's...
We are 31 or 32 minutes in.
Okay, I'm going to go through this really quickly then.
Okay.
Now there was a show on TV here in Canada when I was really young, and when I mean really young, I mean like 4 before I went to school, I think. And this is the type of programming that Canada had and North America, I guess. And I didn't understand it, and I found it very weird. It was on about 1:30 or 2:00 in the afternoon, And I remember I dreaded it every time it came on. It was a show that I think was called Doctor's Diary. Now, it was a show that took place in like a psychiatric doctor's office. And they'd have these real life cases, which I think is bullshit. But they had these real life cases. And all it was is that these couples or this guy or this woman would talk about their problems. And the only good thing that I think ever came out of that show, and I never really watched it because it was awfully dour and depressing. And it was...
You have to watch someone talk about their problems
for half an hour. Yes, that's exactly what it was for half an hour. It was like, oh, and it would be serious stuff for 1:30 in the afternoon. Like, you know, I'm an alcoholic and I, you know, and I do this and that. And you got the guys acting and it was terrible. And I just thought that, you know, this is inappropriate. Even at that age, I was going like, I don't want to watch this. But I could see like housewives watching it. I actually could.
I got to look up the word pathos and see if that applies.
The only good thing about it is that SCTV, which satirized almost all of Canadian TV, did a satirization of that show, which I remember. I didn't know that it was a satirization until much later when I thought about that show, because the show was on in the early 70s and we were both so young.
Yeah.
But it had such an indelible... bad memory for me that I've never escaped it. They did Chipmunk Rody doing the counseling. Rody for the counselors. Counselor.
Yeah, Rody counselor. Yeah.
And that was it. Really was exactly what the show was, but they made it funny by making Chipmunk as the counselor. And you know, the woman would say, "Oh, he gets up and then he does this, and it's such garbage." And then you know, Chipmunk would go, "Could you say that a little bit louder to the mic?"
And Chipmunk, for those of you who don't know, was one of the head Rodies at the Woodstock.
Yes. Yes. And he did all the low. Announcements like, "Oh, there's some bad brown acid out there, man.
There's some heavy weather coming." Hunker down for 20 minutes and on some positive waves, we'll get through this.
And it was very funny. And the more as I get older and I remember these shows that were on Canadian TV, they satirized almost everything. Almost most of the stuff, 80% of the stuff that you think that they came up with was actually just a satirization of something that was on Canadian TV. It really was.
Yeah.
They
savaged commercials.
They did commercials that used to come on Canadian TV. And
it was so easy to take those apart because they just had such a fake routine formula that, you know, no one even thought about how right or wrong. It was what they did.
Yeah. Now, it's funny because there's no tapes of this Doctor's Diary. You're never going to find it. It's thankfully lost. But it's kind of like, too bad it's not lost forever, because I think it'd be very funny today. I think it would be a very entertaining. I would like to see a lot of these shows that they erased. I just can't believe. I know that it was unbelievably expensive to keep just one show. Because videotape, people may not understand, who are a little younger maybe than us. But... it was like $50 a tape, like seriously. And I'm probably being conservative. So that's a lot of tape if you wanted to keep everything that you put out. So I understand it, but there were some things that were really important that they never, didn't keep. And I just like, oh, okay. No, whatever. Show did need keeping, but it would be very funny to see nowadays. They had some really bad shows in the set.
Boy, it's so easy nowadays. You can keep everything because digital information
is... They do. Everything is kept. It's funny. We came from an age... And people say, well, why didn't you... You never thought. You saw something maybe on a rerun in the summertime, and then you knew that it wasn't coming on again, and you just didn't... Well, that was the way life was. Yep. You only appreciate it when life is different. And life became different when everybody had video cassette recorders and they started taping things. And then they could say, you know what? Now it's cheap. It only costs a couple of bucks for videotape. Why don't we just tape everything? Just like Jerry Todd said, why not tape everything? Oh, yeah.
I remember taping all the early SCTVs when they were on.
Yeah. Because, But that wasn't, and I try and tell the young kids, because a lot of them say, well, why isn't that, why can't we watch that show you always talk about? Why did they erase it? That seems so stupid. I said, nowadays it seems stupid. But back then, you just didn't watch anything after it was done. You just didn't. And it was a way of life. You don't question something that's a way of life. It's like when you're born and your parents are dysfunctional. That's the way you think all families are. Yeah, right? Oh, your parents are really good. That's the way you think all parents are like. That's the way life was. And you never questioned it. If they forgot to tape a Super Bowl and erased it, you said, well, nobody will watch it again. That was the way it just was. Nobody will watch that Super Bowl again. So, I agree with you. It aggravates us, but we lived in that culture. We do understand that once it got played, whether it was an entertainment show or a hockey event or a sports event, you were unlikely to see it again, and it was just a way of life.
Yeah, I think a lot of those shows only existed when people started getting early VCRs and taping them at home, and then
that's when people start to collect things.
Yeah.
And that's when a whole revolution started in the 80s, and then they started keeping everything. And now, of course, everything is kept. You got 300 stations out there, and they keep everything.
Now, keeping everything costs nothing.
You put it on a little
stick that we plug into the computer that holds, a million songs.
Yeah, exactly. That's a million albums.
A million albums.
How many albums does this hold? A million.
Hand me the screwdriver.
Okay. Even with the show where we had nothing, we're running long.
Get us talking. No, don't get us talking.
Today we are going to review the 1975 album by David Crosby and Graham Nash, called Wind on the Water. Now, this was a... See, I can't go through this. I can't go through David Crosby's life. I'd be here for a week. but as you know, David Crosby was in... Hopefully, you all know David Crosby started off as a folk musician in the early 60s and was in a band with a couple of... Was in the band basically with the Byrds even before they went electric, and then they saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, and they said, we got to go electric.
We got to do that, yeah.
He found himself in one of the greatest bands of all time. That's just a start. Now, I'm going to just throw some stats at you, I guess, both at Rob and our audience.
And you, the audience.
Crosby's combined work with the Byrds and Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young has sold over 35 million albums.
Ooh. Wow. That's nothing to sneeze at.
He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame twice. Obviously, you know what it is. Once for his work in the Byrds, and again for being in Crosby, Stills, and Nash. Five albums to which he contributed to are included in Rolling Stone's list of the 500 greatest albums of all time. Three with the Byrds and two with CSNY. CSN with the CSN album and the Y with the Deja Vu. So he was on many, many prominent albums. I mean, every Byrds album was was a landmark, that alone. He got kicked out of the Byrds in 1967 because he was known as quite an egomaniac. And he could be very hard, as everybody knows, he was very hard to get along with. He was the first one to admit that, especially back in the 60s when he was taking a lot of medicinal medicine, I guess we would say.
Yeah, you get old, you take your medicine.
Well, he wasn't old, but he was still taking medicine.
He was practicing for when he gets old.
So he got fired. Roger McGuinn and Chris Hillman went to his house and said, We can't stand you anymore, David. We can't stand you anymore as a human being. You're just impossible to be with. I know what that's like. When you're in a band, there's always that one guy, and I understand completely how they feel. I do. I really do. And so that's when he was floating around without a band, and all of a sudden Stephen Stills was floating around without a band because Buffalo Springfield had broken up and Graham Nash had just left the Hollies, so he was without a band, and they came together at a party and sang together, and history was made, and Crosby, Stills, and Nash made their album in 69, and then blah, 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 it became huge, and then Neil Young joined because they needed another guitarist on stage. So you had Deja Vu, which is one of the greatest selling albums of all time. And then he worked in 1970, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, as always, couldn't get along. They lasted about a year. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, a year from the time they started touring in Woodstock. And Woodstock was their second gig, till the time that they broke up about a year later, almost exactly to the day, in 1970. And they just couldn't stand each other. There was debates over Rita Coolidge, who was getting Rita Coolidge, and all this crap that happens when you take too much drugs again and you have too big of an ego. So they all kind of went their separate ways in 1970. David Crosby made what we consider an excellent album. A lot of people consider it nowadays a classic album, If I Could Only Remember My Name, which was just sabotaged at the press at the time, but it's now completely been reevaluated. I love that album. If there's any album by David Crosby you should get to really kind of get where his zeitgeist is, it's that album. And then he decided to combine forces with Graham Nash for three or four albums. Three studio albums and a live album. Four albums in the mid-70s. One of them we're going to, just in a minute here, going to review, Wind on the Water. All four of those albums, even and the live album also, is just excellent. I mean, I shouldn't say that. But what I'm saying is they were so much better than people thought they were. The combination of both of them together made for, I think, all three of their studio albums were exemplary. And their live album was cooking. And that was all we heard from David Crosby for a long time. He had the cocaine problem, he had the heroin problem, he had the freebasing problem. And you know, he would guest on like Crosby. He'd make some Crosby, Stills, and Nash albums in the 80s, but mostly he was just there. And he didn't really do anything for a long time. And we're not going to really get into that. What we're going to say is that at the end of his life, the last 5 years, 6 or 7 years actually, he came back and he recorded his first solo album in 2014, since his first one in 1971, If I Could Only Remember My Name, called Cross. And then he just pumped them out, three or four albums before he passed away, which was kind of a really, four albums in 6 years, as I read here. Huh. Very, very impressive. I still have to listen to them, but I hear they're very good and very impressive to be almost 80 years old and be, all of a sudden get this burst of energy to create this music that you haven't really done, in all honesty, in probably 40 years to that extent. And he kind of ended his life like on top of the game. You know, he really did. He admitted his mistakes. He had a falling out with all the other members of Crosby, Stills, except for Stephen Stills. He kept a good relationship with him, but he said some things about Neil Young, which I think were true to a certain extent, that Neil Young wouldn't talk to him. Not about Daryl Hannah, his girlfriend. I'm not going there, but about some of the shitty things that Neil Young has done as a musician to his friends. And so Neil Young wasn't talking to him. He made some snarky comments about Graham Nash that, again, I think should not be said in public, but I don't think he was wrong. I'm not going to say what they were. They're domestic issues that I don't want to get into on this show. But David Crosby is not a person who shied away from saying what he felt, and people hated him for it and people loved him for it. I was on both. I didn't get to know the guy, so I really liked him. You know what I mean? When you get to hear stuff.
I know some of his music and reputation. So.
Yeah. Not knowing the guy, it's probably pretty good, but we have been around people like that, and they can, you know, and it's a lot better to hear about them than to actually be around them. But gotta be one of the most colorful characters I think I said this when I was talking about how he had passed away, that he has to be the most colorful character in rock history. I can't think of anybody so divisive as David Crosby. He was just, and it's hard to believe he's gone. It just seemed like, you know, he should have died 50 years ago. But when he died, it was like, no, Keith Richards and David Crosby don't die. So we'll see about Keith. Maybe he could hang in there.
I think Keith's going to 110.
That'd be cool if Keith did. I don't know how he could do that. He looks like 130.
Yeah. He'll probably look like 170 by the time he's 110.
So we're going to talk about, this is the second duo album from Crosby and Nash called Wind on the Water in 1974. This came after their big 1974 tour with Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, which was a very bitter tour. It was a great tour musically, because they did like 4-hour shows and they did all these songs separately and together, and it was just a
musically beautiful.
Musically beautiful show. They really were. I have actually tapes of every single show on their tour. Every single show that was taped, I actually have it from their 74 tour. And there's a great, I can't remember now, I have it. It's 2 or 3 CDs set of that Graham Nash put together about 7 or 8 years ago. Kind of a combination of the best songs on the tour, and it's just phenomenal. I give it 4.5 stars. I just think it's one of the best live albums I've ever heard, just because the sound is beautiful and you get to hear Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young in their prime in the mid-70s when all the cocaine was happening and all that. Now, the thing about the 74 tour was blah, blah, blah. A lot of cocaine, a lot of other drugs, a lot of money spent. They played stadiums, and yet I read that they only came out after the whole tour with $1 million each, which was a pittance of what they should have gotten. People stole from them. There's a song on this album that's about that, from Graham Nash, called Take the Money and Run. It left a bitter taste in everybody's mouth, and it took them a long time to get over and to get back together. Not that they had conflicts too much with each other, but it was, why do a tour and then have other people take our money?
And see, again, that's my point of view of songwriting nowadays, where if you write a song and it becomes a hit, a whole bunch of people make money off that song, and you hardly see anything.
Exactly.
Holy mackerel.
That's exactly, especially when nowadays when people write songs with 5 people. How expect to get any money when you write songs with 5 people and that doesn't make any much money? I'm going to sneeze.
All right, I'm going to talk about my week, and the week I had.
I loved your week. Now,
bless you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Should be edited out, but we don't do that.
It's okay. He didn't sneeze into the microphone.
Sorry, that's really rude, but what can I do? Holy smokes. So the 74 tour also, again, it's like the story of the 1970s and rock and roll. Way too much egos involved, people taking too long in their solo 20-minute sets or 3 songs they're supposed to do, and all of a sudden Stephen Stills is doing 5 songs, and a lot of paranoia because they're taking a lot of coke, and it was the 1970s and being a rock star, a typical thing. And I love the story, of course, Neil Young driving in his camper away from everybody else, away from all the shit. But still, you know, doing his sort of thing. Very strange, very wild tour, very 70s. It happened like on every tour. Any band that didn't do cocaine was very rare back then. Anyways, this is kind of like the first album to be released after that tour for David Crosby and Graham Nash. I love the idea of Crosby and Nash being together as a pair. They both write. I gotta say this before we review the album. I really like David Crosby as a songwriter, and I think Rob will probably know why. Is that he kind of writes songs the way I like to write songs, which is they kind of go off in different times in the middle of the song, and little key signatures, which I like to do. They have, the song can be a David Crosby song. Like when I hear a David Crosby song, a lot of times I wish I would have wrote it because it's so similar to the way I write a song. His songs can all of a sudden start off really jumpy and then go really down into minor chords. And I love doing that. It's almost my MO, because it's almost something I almost have to do because I love doing it so much, is to create the dynamics in the song and to make it, you know, cheery. I don't like to play a song like 5 minutes straight of whatever. And I don't like to make it complicated. Rob likes his songs complicated sometimes, where it has different parts.
7 or 8 parts.
Yeah, and I'm not that kind of guy. I'm a David Crosby guy. I'm a guy that likes to have the a couple of mood shifts in a song within a 3 or 4 minute song. So I really identify with David Crosby. That kind of puts me in a, hopefully I'm rightfully judgmental in what I'm, how I'm going to review it, but I've always felt myself to be probably the closest songwriter to my own style is David Crosby, or to the style that I wish I had is David Crosby. And so, and I like his, I like the two, like Graham Nash's more sunny disposition compared to like the moodiness of David Crosby. I think it works very well on this album. First off, I want to talk about some songs. They're basically half and half, right, on this album?
Yes, yeah. So there's one song that's written by both of them lyrically. Yeah.
And I love Carry Me. I've heard this album before. I will admit, I've heard this album quite a few times before. One of the reasons I chose it, I have heard all the Crosby and Nash albums, and this is the one I wanted to do. Even though I don't, there is not a bad Crosby and Nash album, at least in the 70s. I did not like their album that they made. They made a 2-CD album. Holy fuck. Sorry. I can't remember the year, 2002, something like that. They made a very middle-of-the-road album, and it was very boring, and I didn't like it at all. But there's stuff in the 70s. Everybody, when they were doing stuff in the 70s, had a certain realism and edge to them. You know, even the laid back, like this would be characterized as soft rock. Would you say, Rob?
Yes, definitely. I did the first comment I put, and I put this on another album before, and I was thinking, what other album did I say this to? But it has no sharp edges, no jagged things poking in your ear. And I think it was David Crosby's solo album I had said that about before.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was the other one I mentioned.
They were very good. All of the members of, Graham Nash and David Crosby were very good at making, I would say, what you said, very slick albums, but with an edge.
Yeah, I mean, the parts were really good, but they weren't abrasive.
Yes.
There was nothing it was smooth transitions, smooth sounds, smooth singing.
And I love, you're right. There is still, and of course, you have the best musicians playing on this record. And again, I'm not a big fan of a whole lot of people playing. There's a whole lot of people playing on this album, but it does flow. So it doesn't seem like there's a whole bunch of music. There's Levon Helm playing on this album. There's the great Russ Kunkel playing drums, and I could name them all, but I'm not. Tim Drummond on bass.
Jackson Brown came in and sang.
Jackson Brown singing background. James Taylor played and sang on, like, it was just filled with people, which I don't think is necessary because it all sounds really good together as a unified.
I think that they did more people. They were doing that for fun.
Yeah, that's what you did in the 70s. Yeah. Is that you're making an album, you invite people to listen, and all of a sudden they guest on it. That's just the way it was. Anyways, "Carry Me" is one of my favorite songs. It is again very typical of a song that I would write. And he wrote it about his mom dying, and I get choked up every time I listen to it, especially this last verse, which is, it's a true story about seeing his mom at around that time that he wrote the song in 1973, and she's lying in the bed, and she's kind of like, she's dying, and she kind of says, I want to go. I really want to go. But I'm going to carry me over. And it's a very emotional song. I love it. I think it's, again... David Crosby at his high point. I just think it's a thrilling song. I love this song, Bittersweet, although I think it's done a little bit better on another album. But I like that David Crosby song. I'm just trying to, Cowboy of Dreams, of course. I've heard Cowboy, that's a Graham Nash song about Neil Young, which I get endless pleasure from. They're on a boat. This is an often heard story that has been taken as, sometimes people think it's just a legend, but it's actually true. Around this time, Neil invited Graham out to his ranch in California, and they went out on a boat, and Neil said, "I'm going to play you my new album, but we have to go out in the boat on the lake." It's typical Neil Young. So they go out in the boat, and on one side of the speakers was the house. They had like one side, like left side or whatever. And the barn had the other side, stereo. So they're listening in the boat, kind of rowing out there. And all of a sudden, they're listening to his album. And Neil yells out, "More barn! We need more barn!" So Graham Nash said, I just had the most wonderful time, you know, spending an afternoon and listening to Neil's album with Neil is just an experience and a half. And he wrote this song about that afternoon and that, you know, just about Neil Young. It's a great song. Homer Through the Haze, again, a David Crosby song. It sounds like I would write, with the kind of mood and everything. Again, I love this song, but it's much better done by Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, which I heard on their box set, which is an outtake. But this is still a great version. And I love the, well, this is breathtaking, but the Crosby, David Crosby, the song To the Last Whale, which is the last song on the album, the critical mass part of the song, which is...
The vocals.
The acapella vocals.
That almost sound like... not gospel, but definitely choir.
Choir-like. But yeah. There is a definitely... Yeah, I can't... Choir-like, and that's all I can say.
Yes, it's choir-like without being choir. It's.
It was written by David Crosby. The Graham Nash part is the Wind on the Water song. And critical mass is just breathtaking. I got no other word for it. It's breathtaking. And I've heard this song, I don't know how many times, since 1990. Ever since I bought their four-disc box set called CSN, and this was on it. I said, this is just, I mean, this is why these guys are legends. You don't get to be legends just because you're in Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. You get to be legends because you contribute to all these bands that you're in.
You gotta have the work to back you up. I hate that.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, for me, I want,
you know, you just don't. I mean, you would get people are smart enough to know you're just hanging on, and the band is smart enough to know you're just hanging on. They get rid of you. These guys contribute a lot, and you can tell by this album. I could talk about most of these songs. I'm not, but I just think Wind on the Water and Critical Mass, which is together the song To the Last Whale, is just a breathtaking song. And when they sing the part after that, when the song goes into it, and then they sing, you know, wind on the, how it breaks, goes right down, and they sing that. It's just amazing. It's like those, that's the prime of their voices, and that's the prime of their songwriting, and it just gets you. And there are a couple of songs that, of course, you have 11 songs, which is a lot, and you're writing every year. You're going to have a couple of clunkers. There are a couple of songs that I'm not exactly thrilled about on this record. But overall, this is, to me, an excellent, excellent record. Some of this is the best things that David Crosby has written, and some of this is the best things that Graham Nash has ever written. And that's why you get such a strong album. And that's why you get such a strong combination of David Crosby and Graham Nash together. I love this album from the first time I've heard it, and I was glad to revisit it this week. I really was. Kind of needed to revisit this album, both because of the album and just because I needed, I don't know, just you know, sometimes
this
you
need comfort music.
Yes, I needed something like this at this time for some reason.
I mean, imagine if you're doing an album that you found in the first list and you just you hate it and you got to keep listening to it. I'm in no mood for this week, damn it.
There was a lot of albums we've done in the, let's just say, in the last past, and I'm not saying that they were bad. It's just that
you wouldn't have listened to them if
I was not in the mood, and I have to make yourself in the mood. And I was listening. I wanted something in the last 7 or 8 weeks that that I really wanted to and really affected me in more of just a reviewing sort of way. And this album did it for me. It came along at the right time. So I give it four strong stars. I really think it's an excellent album.
I'm going to talk about the album now.
That's what you do.
Here.
That's what you do.
And yeah. I listened to the album and I got some stuff to say.
How much time do you have to talk about this album?
Okay, we are at 102.
Yeah, lots of time to talk about it now.
We got about another 3 to 8 minutes. Songwriting I really liked in that the chord changes, the way the melodies and harmonies worked over them. These guys, they sing a lot of four-part harmonies and they know chords really well. And this is not simple songwriting.
These are not, especially with David Crosby and Graham Nash, it's a very good point. I wish I would have brought it up. These are not your normal chords. These are not your normal chord changes. And that's another thing I kind of
like. They're not doing like multitudes and lots of chords. They're just the way they're using the chords they are.
Right. It's not like, yes, not sounding where they're like doing a whole bunch of chords and all that stuff. Yeah. What they're doing is they're putting a really weird chord in at the right moment.
I mean, some of these are still 2 and 3 chord songs for the most part.
Yeah.
But just what they're doing with them is really awesome. Lyrically, I love the subject matter. At first, I thought sometimes they could take their topic and it would be a bit drawn out or a bit vague. In that, when I found out what some of these songs were about and reading them, I never would have gotten that from listening to them.
I have to agree. There's a couple of songs that, without reading them, because I couldn't find anything about them, I don't exactly know what it's about. There's about 3 songs on here that I don't exactly know. I can assume. I had no idea. I thought that Take the Money and Run was more about Nixon and the government at the time.
More a political thing.
More of a political thing until I found out it was about their tour.
About the tour. That's I was waiting to ask you tonight what happened there. That you already said it. So, and that's a good example that. To take the money and run, like I say, at first I thought, it's a bit vague and I didn't really know what it was about. And then I find out it's about what happened on the tour, and I never would have got that from the song. But then it occurred to me it's a very subjective song and that you could attach this to any situation where you
And in fact, if you take those same words and apply it to Nixon's government, it works.
Yes,
it works. Word for word.
So,
and that's a great song to be able to make your own assumption about what
it is. Yes, that's why a lot of these songs where I first thought, they might be a bit vague. They actually, afterwards, I sort of appreciate them as being, you can attach your own meanings to them. And
instead of some songs where you go, I don't know what it means, and I can't attach anything to it.
Yes.
Yeah.
These do, because there were enough really powerful lines in it that they grabbed you and they made you listen.
A good example is a song like Homeward Through the Haze, in which you don't exactly know what the singer, which is David Crosby, is talking about, but you know enough from the words that it can be about Vietnam coming home, it can be about just coming home in general, it can be about a whole bunch of things about the political situation back then, but it opens it up to, you can make your own assumption, and that's great songwriting.
I thought of it, the people turning a blind eye to stuff.
Exactly, and that's just as valid.
And that's what I came up with for what it meant, so I saw that as a strength later on, not as a weakness. And the singing, it was weird in that hearing David Crosby and Graham Nash, I'm so used to hearing Crosby, Stills, and Nash, or Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. It reminded me of the theme we did when we had the bands where the singer had left and it was the Alice Cooper Band of the Doors.
Oh, yes, where they put in the new singer, with that theme we did, where they got a new singer for the famous person who left.
It kind of reminded me in that it seemed like he was missing something from that, but it was different in that in those two cases, they had guys singing who were not normally upfront vocalists, whereas these guys are really good, and they are upfront vocalists. And it still, even sounding, given that feeling of missing something a bit, it still sounded really comfortable and really...
Comfortable is a good word.
I was happy to hear these guys.
Some people might say comfortable is like, it's not boring.
Yeah, this is not selling into a groove comfortable. This is like, you know and like these guys, and you recognize them and you feel comfortable.
I totally agree with that statement. Because it can be misinterpreted. In fact, when we say it's a soft rock album, nowadays, that can be, especially when it got to the late 70s, that can be misinterpreted. But even the soft rock in the mid 70s when this was made had an edge to it.
Yeah.
I thought this might even be... It's still a little harder for the soft rock of the mid-70s, but it's still not... it's not hard by any stretch of the
imagination. No. There's a couple songs, like Mama Lion is very... It's kind of like a nice guitar song. But even then, you would say, is that a rock song? You say, well, just barely.
Yeah, just barely. Graham Nash songs.
Yeah,
that,
Graham Nash, to point out, writes a little bit more of a rock and roll sensibility to his, whereas David Crosby is a more melancholy.
Mood.
Which, and I like both. Of course, as I've said before a couple of times on this show, I get really affected by David Crosby's way of writing, which is very unique, just because that's the way, if I don't write like that, that's the way I would like to be heard. That's how I write.
I think I'm almost done. Let me think.
Was there any songs that stood out to you?
I wanted to mention Graham Nash's songwriting. He starts a few of these songs with the piano, and it reminded me of on his solo album, Chicago. I was thinking at the time, you know, something sounds odd about this song. It's not, it's weird. It has a weird feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I kind of identified that in that when he starts playing the piano there for a number of these songs, the Love Workout, Take the Money and Run, and Field Worker, it has a 2-4 feel to it.
He does, and I just want to point out that Field Worker's very strange rhythmically. If you listen, if people listen to that, and I hopefully I didn't interrupt what you were going to say about that, but I noticed that, first of all, I noticed that he starts with that 2-4, which is almost his MO, is to start off with.
Yes.
But he had some really cool time changes in Field Worker. Even though it's a very quick song, he put in really... neat changes in it, and it again, it's an MO of both of them to put in really neat changes and have time signatures.
And there's something being played on the guitar in that song, the rhythm part over it, that it works perfectly, but it sounds like it's a different chord.
Now, I want to point out that if you go by maybe your history of Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. That Graham Nash is just the amiable one who tries to keep people together and has a couple of fun songs like Our House and stuff like that. That is not true. Graham Nash is a powerhouse. We reviewed his first album, Songs for Beginners, which we both just raved about. It was a fantastic album. And his contributions on this album alone is a huge talent. And I just think that he's really got the thrift end of being, he's the guy with the poppy singles, you know, Teach Your Children and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he doesn't get the weight that he can put into his song. And I think that's a shame, because I think he's a major talent and people just think he's that, that nice guy in the band. He's that one nice guy in the band.
When he gets going on a song like singing, I can take the money around the third verse there. He gets right up there and is close to shouting. And
he's a talent. Wind on the Water alone, which he wrote, is a towering song. That's we're talking about a major power here. Like I said, these guys are not hangers-on to the CSN mystique. These are guys that all contributed in their own way. And I hate when people say, like, Graham Nash is just like that fourth spoke or something. I said, no, man. Then you haven't listened.
All these guys have contributed, and they've all contributed a lot. Like, they're all unique.
That's what I liked when I delved into the Crosby and Nash albums from the 70s, the four albums. And the live album I recommend, because it's a cooking live album from a band who's very meticulous in the studio. But I noticed that more than anything, how powerful these two, like how major these two are, like, it's seriously major. Like, right up there with the best songwriters in the 70s, except they're buried by Stephen Stills and Neil Young, who are even bigger towering figures. But I tell you, if they didn't have Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, these two, on their own or together, would have been bigger names. I tell you that right now. I really feel that they would have been, and David Crosby is considered like huge, but a lot of it is again for that periphery stuff that Graham Nash is known for being the peacemaker. David Crosby is known for being like this, the colorful guy, and he does this shit and that shit. But it all comes down to, we appreciate these people because of the amazing music they made. Yeah,
each one of them is a piece in the in what's being done, and it's a unique piece.
And they never, they didn't make this, you know, you can hear a Graham Nash song, you can hear a David Crosby song, you can hear a Stephen Stills song, Neil Young, you know it's them. But they also combined really good when they were together, so yep, that it sounded like CSNY.
If they had not played together for a while, I don't know if this album would have sounded as good as it does. I think it's a lot of the familiar they have with each other that allows them to bring their unique songwriting styles in, and they can play it with each other, and it, they can each come up with good sounds for their songs and make them sound good.
What do you rate this mother?
I started off with a 3.5, but the songwriting, the subject matter, and the chords and the vocals, yeah, I gave it a 4. I bumped it up.
Yeah, this is all about songwriting, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
And you know that. But just for anybody who's listening, that you know, there's a couple of solos on here, but they're not very long. This is all about vocalizing and songwriting, I should say, because their vocals at various points are amazing, and it is a huge part of the album. But it's, hey, if you got good vocals and bad songs, who cares, right?
Yeah.
So this is a songwriter's album, and they always are. Crosby and Nash are not known for slinging their guitars or playing the piano amazingly. They're known for their voices and writing really good songs. And maybe that's what I needed. Maybe I needed just a solid 3 or 4 minute songs, really good songs, into my system. Except, and I'm not criticizing what we've listened to, but you know, I listened to a lot of jazz that had no vocals, and you know, and it was just nice to get some. That's why we have themes, is so that when we're in a funk somehow with the music we're listening to, we got another theme coming up where we can get out of that.
Our theme is, we are finding as we're doing it, is not as enjoyable as we thought. We know it's going to end soon.
A lot of people would find that strange that I would say that, because I did have, gave almost every album a good review that we've done in the last 8 weeks, all the jazz albums and everything, but that's not the point I'm making. I don't know if anybody understands the point I'm making. It's that I can really like an album, but not really want to hear it. It's kind of like my job to do it that
week. Yeah, there's times when I'm in a mood where I want to hear Jeff Beck.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly the point. There's a few
times when I'm not in the mood for that.
And we loved the album. Example. We loved it. I was blown away by it, but I was still thinking, you know, I need something else right now.
Yeah.
It's been 4 jazz albums in a row.
Yeah, you get too much of the same thing.
Yeah.
I had pizza every night. Let's have hamburgers.
Let's put a little bit of something else. Let's put some spinach on it, right?
Yes. Just something to make it different. Well, someone can put some spinach on it, not me.
Somebody put spinach on his pizza. I'm not saying who.
Someone who cares about me.
Too much. Okay, so we both gave it 4 stars. We highly recommend it.
Yeah, I did enjoy listening to this album.
That's about it. That, thank God, is the end of our show. Because we had nothing and I still went over time.
Yep.
We will be taking next week off so I can get the creative juices hopefully running again. And we will be back in 2 weeks. That's 2 weeks, Rob.
2 weeks.
With a new theme and a new album to review. I know the theme. I just don't know the albums yet. So I can't even give that to Rob today.
No, I'll be watching my Skype over the next 2 days.
It will be done within the next 2 days. I'm not going to give anything away.
We don't know nothing. We literally don't know nothing.
I'm going to tell you the story that when we do the theme in 2 weeks, because I have a story behind why I picked the theme. But that's for 2 weeks. I know it's going to be hard to sleep now, but you can wait.
The Gardening Network's going to suffer because we got some exciting programming.
I got some things to say about how I come up with this, and it'll just blow your freaking mind. So I can't wait. I can wait 2 weeks because I need to.
Yeah,
I need
recharge the batteries.
I need to get my mojo back. It just left. My mojo left. I said, hey, mojo, where are you going? Rah, rah, rah. Said something, didn't understand, took the car, left.
I think it was in Japanese.
And he was gone. Did his Toshiro Mifune and left. So until 2 weeks from now, but we will have a show on next week.
Yeah.
Of course, a new show. No, we won't. We won't have any show. No, I get so confused because our schedule is so confusing.
Time is not real. This isn't like South Park. We can do one episode per week and just air it.
I know. Our time is not real to us. It's just some days, some weeks we do two shows a week. Some days we do, we got 2 weeks we never do a show. It's just so confusing. So we won't be on next week. So you can listen to one of our old shows if you want. Not the Grease one. Listen to the Bob Marley one, because we're trying to boost that up.
We got a couple of Bob Marleys out there. They're both good.
Yeah. Try and boost the Bob Marley one, and that's the second one. Joni Mitchell, Ladies of the Canyon. We want that to overtake Grease. That's right up there, too. Listen to those ones. Those are really good. They make you laugh. They make you cry. They make you think about why you're listening to this.
And why you're laughing and crying.
What's
wrong with me?
Until 2 weeks from now, everybody, take care and stay safe.